This is Comics Therapy, episode 22. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, three new comics from December 18th, 2013. Hit number 4, Buzzkill number 4, and Lock and Key Alpha number 2. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we talked with writer Simon Oliver. Just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Hi, Comics Therapy. This is Cameron Williams, Wasgo on Twitter. My favorite ending in recent comic history has to be Journey into Mystery 645. Not only was it a beautiful but very sad ending to a fantastic story, it was also complete. In an age where comics constantly bleed from one into the next, and events are used purely to reshuffle teams, here was a story with a beginning, middle, and terribly sad end. I still don't think I'm over it. I'm not sure when I will be. And that makes me love it.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. Especially Aaron, because today he is drinking and it's awesome. The theme of the show this week is the final countdown. Escaping into the dark, fading to black, leaving on a jet plane, going out in a blaze of glory. You get the idea. It's the end. We're saying goodbye to three comics, two minis, and an epic series that are concluding this week. No crying, not even for Lock and Key. And we'll remind you a couple more times before we get to that particular segment, but it is especially important that you do not ruin that series for yourself if you haven't been reading it. Timestamps are always on the website, so you can skip through Lock and Key. It's the last segment to the hilarious interview with Simon Oliver. Do it for me, if not for yourself. You know who you are.
Are you talking to me?
No, you read it, didn't you?
I'm not really into those kind of comics.
Oh my God. You're the one who got me to read it in the first place. You should take credit.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions.
This is gonna be
great. Celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asked listeners to share their favorite comics endings, be it death of a character or conclusion of a series. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience, and the rest is up to you.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and the show account, at Comics Therapy. So, on the script, Aaron, when I was writing this, I was super pissed off at you, and I was going to make you talk about it, but now you're a little tipsy, and it's adorable, so...
Oh, no. Maybe we should talk about it. We should talk about it.
Okay. You want to talk about why I was angry with you this week?
Yes, and why I was angry with you this week?
Oh, yeah. Go for it. Do you remember?
No. What?
We spent like 2 days fighting about music.
It wasn't 2 days.
Yeah. No, it was totally.
It was like 4
days.
Emails.
Nah, it was like 2 days.
And in the end, what hashtag were we?
You were hashtag compromise. I was hashtag I get to edit, so I get to make the final decision.
And in the end, the hashtag is Aaron is always right.
No.
Look, if it was up to you, this whole podcast would be sadcast every week. It would be a 4 minute like droning dirge that you pick every week to be the intro, and everyone,
that's bullshit.
No one would listen.
That's incredibly inaccurate.
I pick the rockin' tunes that get the people on their feet.
Uh huh.
It's true.
Last week when we opened with No Children from the Mountain Goats.
That's because I would not have picked that, number one. But that's because you and Hansel and Steve Lieber forced me into, on Twitter, to accept that as the intro.
Because it was the right choice. And people, the masses, responded in kind. They thought it was an excellent choice. I got more shit for the closing song last week than I did for the opening song.
Yeah. I would have flipped it and reversed it.
I'm sorry, you would have opened with whom?
Britney Spears.
Right, okay, so I just want everybody to know that you would have made that choice.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't.
In the end,
I am the one who was right.
Wait, in the end, if you have to make a choice, Britney is always the right choice.
And this week, what was your suggestion for what we should open with?
The final countdown.
Uh-huh, and so I hope that everybody takes note of that. And when you're listening to the show, you can recall back to what you actually heard the show began with.
You better use that.
I have a very tiny little bit of power in the universe, and sometimes it's fun to play with it.
No, that's dumb. If you don't use that, that's a breach of our trust. If we compromised and agreed on something, you have to use that.
You compromised? Did I actually use the word compromise?
Yes, you said, okay, compromise.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe I lied.
Well, that's not cool. Because your choice is super boring, and it's like, oh my god, I would want to shoot myself before the show even started.
Well.
Let's talk about our week. I don't even care.
That was my week. My week was being angry about music.
Oh my god. You need more things to do.
This is probably because I just reread this book over Thanksgiving, but I really love the end of Mark Millar's Old Man Logan. The entire story, he is a pacifist and won't engage his claws until the final moment when he returns home to find all his hardships and pain was for nothing. Then we get the full splash page of the work, Fate, and you know it's on. It's such a bittersweet ending that is violently satisfying and a great book for the holiday. Left parenthesis, L-O-L, right parenthesis. Notable endings also to include on this list: Remender's End of Uncanny X-Men, Secret Wars, partially because it was my first book, and the end of The Amazing Spider-Man because it's damn near perfect. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Now, what else happened for you this week?
I don't know. Stuff. Things.
Comics.
Comics.
Right.
So many comics.
Do you still have snow?
Nope. All the snow is gone. It's okay. Back to regular Oregon. Just drizzly, misty.
Got it.
Dreary.
That's lame.
We have a tree up in our house.
Oh, for Christmas?
I think so. I'm not really sure how this stuff works, but that's what people tell me.
Right? Is it decorated, or did you just have, like, a tree?
No, it's decorated.
Is it the right kind of tree? Because, I don't know, it's kind of fun to picture it being like a little apple tree with some stuff hanging off of it.
No, I think it's right. Trees are pretty cheap here.
Oh, because you live in the woods.
I just live where all the Christmas trees are grown. Yeah, so, right. So they're not very expensive.
I've never purchased a Christmas tree. I have no idea how much Christmas trees cost.
I mean, I know how much they cost here. I think they're more expensive other places. Like, growing up, you know, I grew up in the woods. We went out and cut down our own trees.
That is something to be proud of.
Yeah. Dragged it back through the woods, through the snow, barefoot.
Both ways?
Both ways.
Right.
Here, they're $20 for, like, a 8-foot tree.
Huh. Okay. And then what do you do with it? You just, like, put it in your house.
You put it in your house, you put stuff on it. And
I mean, I'm not unfamiliar with the concept of a Christmas tree. Please let me, like, clarify that I'm not a fucking moron. I've just never actually done any of that myself.
That's kind of surprising because, like, I mean, yes, both our families are Jewish, but we still had Christmas. I mean, we still did Easter when I was growing up.
I have Christmas at my parents' house. Yeah. But Christmas, when your parents do the stuff for you,
that,
when you actually do any of the faith-based part.
Right, I forgot that you don't stay home for Christmas either.
Well, there's not a lot of data here. Last year and this year, that is correct. Last year and this year, where home is not Pittsburgh, that is correct.
Right, but adults would normally maybe stay in their house with their children and then their parents.
What is this normally? What does that even mean?
I have data. I have like a Kinsey-type report on what you know traditional adults might do. And you fall outside of the norm.
On so many things.
Yep, that's absolutely. Hmm. Anyway.
Well, so are you ready for Christmas?
Yeah, we have literally 35 presents for Luke.
Okay, that's disgusting.
And this is all Chrissy. I'm throwing her under the bus now.
Okay.
Who also said, like 2 months ago, we're not going to buy Luke any presents. He doesn't need anything more. He doesn't, you know, it's ridiculous to buy a bunch of presents for kids for Christmas. It just spoils them. And I'm looking right now at like 6 Amazon boxes just filled with a brand worth of stuff. In her defense, it cost us about like $100.
Okay.
Because we live in America and, you know, things are aplenty and you can find deals. Like, it's about $500 worth of presents that cost about $100.
Okay.
Because of all these, like, you know.
Give me a range of what kind of stuff is he getting?
There's a bunch of learning things. There's a...
learning is good.
One of those leap pads. There's transformers. There's... oh, there's all kinds of crap. I'm excited for him. I want half of them. So maybe it's presents for everyone.
Presents for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have a lot of presents for a kid who already has a ton of toys and who would be happy just opening boxes that were empty, probably.
Right.
But we're doing our part.
And what part is that exactly?
I don't know. Supporting the economy, I guess.
Oh, good job.
Yeah, thank you.
Good show. Yeah.
That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
Yeah. I feel like I read that somewhere.
Or watched it?
No, I mean about the meaning of Christmas.
Oh, sure.
Something about what the reason for the season is. Commerce, I think.
For sure. I mean, isn't everything?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I like Christmas time just fine. I would actually like it to be colder and snowing. Like, I really wish we lived in an area that was snowing and cold during Christmas.
Like last week in Oregon?
Yeah, I really wish that was our Christmas time.
Well, are you going to take any time off, even though you're not going anywhere?
I'm taking a couple of days off in January.
Okay.
The second week of January.
What about Christmas?
No, why?
I don't know, I just like to hang out with your family or something.
I hang out with them all day, I work from home.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
If anything, taking a day off would be going into work.
What about, like, New Year's?
No. No, actually, I'm working New Year's weekend.
New Year's is on Wednesday.
Right, but there's that, you know, people really aren't working that much that week.
Yeah.
And part of being an IT dude and sysadmin is you end up doing a lot of, like, big projects during either Christmas or New Year's because usage is really low, and that's when you can kind of take down servers and replace things.
Sure.
So I'll be working Christmas weekend and New Year's weekend.
How noble of you.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then what are you taking time off in January for?
I'm going to go to this Image Expo thing in San Francisco.
Oh, awesome. I live in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We should hang out.
I don't like to meet people face to face.
Oh, right.
That's weird.
Hey, me neither. I'm super shy. I don't really like people at all. So it's probably best that if you just come in and don't tell me that you're here, and then we don't have to actually... like, accidentally run into one another.
You can Skype me.
No. I mean, like, with voice or with picture?
You can just tweet me.
Yeah, that's probably a better... Let's just... Why muddy a good thing?
Nope, but I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really good. Like, they keep adding more and more people every day that's going to be there.
I'm not going, so I haven't really paid attention to it.
Well, you should check it out, because I'm going in our name and... planning to
our name. That's adorable.
And planning to interview people, and we're going under the umbrella of Comicosity as well.
That's true.
Yeah, and cool people from Comics Bulletin are going to be there, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a big day.
Yeah.
I'm excited for it. But let's talk about some comics.
Okay. Are you going to talk about comics for 90 seconds, or do you want to talk about them for longer than that?
Let's not do the timer this week.
Why? Because you want more than 90 seconds?
Yeah, because I've been drinking, so I want to reminisce.
Oh, for the love of God. No.
Let's talk about the past, and let's talk about now. I'm going to talk about what we talked about I was going to talk about.
I don't remember what we talked about.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about, though.
Okay.
I'm not going to pull a fast one.
Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds, unless he's been drinking, and then he gets a pass, to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. One book, one new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing. Go ahead.
Okay, let's talk about Dark Horse Presents.
Okay.
Which is number... 31.
Okay.
This week. So of, I don't know, volume 6 or something. But Dark Horse Presents... did you ever read that back in the day?
No.
I was lucky enough to have, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 of those, you know, from the, like, late 80s, early 90s. And it was always kind of baffling because I never got it, like, the start of a storyline. You know, Dark Horse Presents is an anthology series.
Right.
Where it's always broken up, you know, mini comics, multiple mini comics within a single large issue.
Right.
And it had such... you know, like cool things like Trekker and Boris the Bear and Aliens and Concrete and like cool, it's just really cool stuff. And it still has been doing that. It's like, it's a great series. It's just kind of expensive.
I never read a lot of Dark Horse stuff when I was younger. I'm trying to think of anything that I read.
I read very little just because it was the 90s, and most stuff our store got was just, you know, Marvel or DC. Mm-hmm. Or at least that I was even aware of. You know, right. I'm sure I could have gotten it. It just wasn't the same as it is today, where you could get exposure to things that just weren't, you know, in the store. So the few of those that I had, it was really intriguing because it wasn't Spider-Man, it wasn't Superman, it wasn't Batman.
Gotcha.
And, like, you'd read this, like, random middle arc, you know, middle of the story thing of, like, Concrete, which is a very kind of introspective, esoteric, you know, sort of superhero-ish kind of story, and you just kind of wonder, what is this all about? But the modern, you know, version of it has really spawning a ton of good Dark Horse stories. Like, they use it well, and they put it out, and I don't know what the sales are like. I usually don't pick it up, because it's pretty expensive. It's $8 an issue. You get a ton of story. You get, like, 90 pages of comics, but, you know, with anthologies, you might only like a third, two-thirds of the stories. So it's hard for me sometimes to justify buying. But the cool thing, that what Dark Horse does, is the popular stuff, or the really good stuff from it, they collect, and then we'll make mini-series from. So things like Resident Alien, you know, started out as a Dark Horse Presents story. But it's really good, so that it gets, you know, continued in its own ongoing series.
So what made you pick it up this time?
I picked it up this time simply because it has a mind management small story in it.
Oh, okay.
I read it often because we get the media copies. But it's not something I feel compelled to collect because I know the really good stuff from it is going to get continued as ongoing series with Dark Horse. But because I'm sort of semi-obsessed with mind management,
Just a little bit.
Well, I think it's one of the best, you know, comics out there.
I agree.
So, you know, even though it's a, you know, a six-page story, it's still something I wanted to have. And they're put together so well. It's like, it, you know, as a print comic, they're really lovely. An Andreaism. So
that's an Andreaism?
Yeah, you use lovely a lot.
Okay.
I think it's lovely when you use lovely.
Keep drinking, Myers.
Yeah, well.
So why don't we talk about comics that I can participate in?
Fine.
Hey, Aaron. Hey, Andrea. Jason Sachs here, at Jason Sachs, on the Twitter. I won't promise to do anything nearly as spectacular as Keith M.P. Silva does in his calls, but I'm just going to go ahead and answer your question about my favorite series ending. Insert sound of gunfire behind me. My favorite series ending is Hitman, which is a book I think lives in the shadow a little bit of Preacher, which is a fine and dandy comic if you like Preacher. But I loved Hitman because it's a book with soul, a book with passion, a book with life, a book with energy, and a book with a lot of damn bullets. And so when our hero goes out with his friends in a giant blaze of glory, like the men they were, facing the reality of the brutal world that they live in, it was just such a perfect, beautiful, fitting ending to the book. That's it. I can't promise slickness, like I said, but I hope it's a good answer. Thanks. Catch you later. Great podcast. Bye.
Our first book this week is Hit Number 4, written by Bryce Carlson and drawn by Vanessa R. Del Rey, with colors by Archie Van Buren and lettering by Ed Dukeshire. Right? The cover is by Ryan Sook. Hit is published by Boom Studios.
Yeah, I'm not doing recaps for anything this week because they're all ending. And what? I don't know. I was lazy.
You're the worst.
No, not really. I'm lovely.
You can't use your own ism on yourself. That's like a singularity.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay, well, it's a pulp noir comic.
So here is my response to that.
Yep.
I think that maybe I don't understand what pulp and noir mean when we use them to describe everything.
I think it's a term that gets overused way too much.
Right.
But this is definitely a noir. Because
it's fantastic. I fucking love this. I love gangster stories. I love this miniseries.
Okay, but it's a particular type of genre and style.
Yeah, but I would have used, I don't know, I think I would have used the word gangster or crime or something before I stumbled on the word noir.
Sure, but noirs, I only know this, and I know it better when I'm sober, because I took as an English major, I took several noir classes in college.
Okay.
And one of them specifically was about Los Angeles noir type stories.
Sure.
And this is that. Because of the setting, this like exposition type.
With the third person omniscient narrator?
That and the internal monologue, and because
it's not his, it's not it's
right,
not his
right.
Monologue.
But it's both. There's kind of. I think it waffles back and forth too.
No, it really doesn't. I went back and looked at it very clearly today because of that, because it goes against what you expect, but you never actually hear his thoughts.
Regardless, I would say that yeah, that still falls under it.
Sure. Okay.
But it's also the setting. Like, there's a very specific style of book that is set in L.A. That is that's crime, murder type stories, mm-hmm. detective type stories.
That's fine. I think it's fantastic. I feel like we use those words. We use noir and we use pulp. And maybe it's because
pulp noir is different than pulp. Or noir. Like, the two of them together mix and make a new thing.
That's fine. You can attempt to school me on this, and I'm okay with that. Because I'm admitting that I feel like my understanding of the transitions between those terms and how we throw them around has gotten, like, super muddy recently. There are so many more titles out now that are using that to self-identify.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, to go, like, to pulp. Something like The Shadow or Captain Midnight, mm-hmm. something like that, is a pulp book.
Right, and I would have correctly gotten that on a multiple choice test. I don't think that I would have put this one in that same category.
No, but it is a pulp noir in that it is gritty crime, adventure, action set with murder, intrigue, a femme fatale... You know, a male protagonist who is uncovering and overcoming and is also, you know, spurned by her in the end, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there are things that you mix the two of them, then it becomes its own kind of thing. So, you know, it's specific, even though, yes, I agree. Both of those terms get thrown around too much and there's not enough differentiation. And it's also, when you hear that now these days, it's like, another one. Because there's a lot of comics like
that. Right. But when they're done well, they stand on their own as incredibly successful stories. And I think Hit is... I think it's pretty great. It has a lot of those identifiable... I don't know if you want to call them tropes or not. But absolutely the characteristics that you just listed off. And the location. But aesthetically... It really, like, all comes together in a quite successful package. And I think that the... way that they embraced the miniseries format is also something to be lauded, because the fourth issue actually notes at the very end, like, that endings are a bitch. I mean, it actually says that. And I think that is there's a danger in kind of setting out to tell a complete story in a small package, like a four issue miniseries, and getting caught up in, well, maybe we can do more with this. And maybe we're not going to end it so completely. We're going to let that be the jumping off point for something larger. And mm-hmm. and you don't always have to do that. There's something just kind of nice about like a standalone exploration of a character or a setting or a story.
Well, do you think you don't think this is set up for more?
I'm not saying that this isn't. I think that it could be, and certainly the introduction of the kind of new team at the end gives that feel. I'm saying that for once, I would actually be content if it was not the jumping off point for a new story.
Right, where you don't feel like, oh, you left me hanging. Okay, we're waiting for volume 2.
Because I don't feel like I was left hanging. I feel like the resolution was exactly what it needed to be given the context of a four issue miniseries. And there are not a lot of, well, I guess maybe this year specifically, I have been unfulfilled by a number of miniseries. And this one, was pretty fucking spot on. If it leads to an ongoing with some of these characters, and especially in this world, which I just think is like really packaged in a lovely way, just to keep using my word, right?
Right.
Then that's fine. But I don't, like, I'm not angry that it's ending. And sometimes I take this shit personally, so.
No, okay, yeah. I see what you're saying. I think that's fair. I think there will be more of this, but you don't have to read more in order to feel like you are missing or not missing something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that's a good way of putting it. I think that's a hallmark of a good story.
Absolutely.
And that's a good way of kind of breaking down the miniseries, what's successful or not.
Yeah, I mean, if the miniseries takes a... If a miniseries takes like a crazy left turn halfway through, and I feel like now I was like duped and now I'm reading a different story, generally that's not a win for me. If the miniseries ends and there are still so many questions that I feel like it was a hurry up and be done kind of situation, then that's not a win for me. And I think there's a fine line there. And four issues especially, as opposed to six, that takes some writing chops to get in enough of the exposition and the kind of character arcs that we see and the introduction of conflict and like all of those very basic storytelling devices, and yet still end it in such a way that feels resolved without tying up every single loose end.
Yeah. I will not disagree with that.
Oh, come on. Just say I agree with you, Andrea.
To
say you are right, Andrea.
I find your hypothesis and explanations to be acceptable to the general populace.
Uh-huh.
And would not publicly disagree with you. Let's move on.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Hello, fellow Comics Therapy clients. It's Keith Silva, talking about endings. If the music didn't give it away already, my blink response was Watchmen, both Watchmen endings. When I read this series first, in singles, just saying, and later, as an older and wiser man, I thought it was brilliant. Still. The ending of the movie made sense, mainstream movie-wise. Watchmen, in the end, has to convey a threat. Paranoia. Bomb Blast is as good as a giant Lovecraft monster. Almost. The other book is 100% by Paul Pope. I swear you people are going to read some Paul Pope comics. Humor me. If you only allow yourself one Pope, you monsters, read 100%. Here's the thing. It's a romance comic, a love story about young love and older love, and the kind of weird burlesque where you can see the inside of a woman's body. Yeah, I never have quite gotten that part either. The burlesque, not the lady parts. On that, I'm good. A good ending has to satisfy, and at the same time, create promise. Pope does that with 100%. It's a mature work about finding love, losing love, and how coming out on the other side, a little more self-assured, is always a good thing. And the last panel, it's pretty amazing. Again. Oh, and Sharon and Isaiah, if you're listening, please don't end this little internet drama of yours anytime soon. After THN, Panel Culture, and the Orbital Comics podcast, you're my favorite. God, what am I saying? It's like picking your favorite Myers's. You love them all. Thanks for the last 21 episodes. And good tidings in the new year to all the clients out there. And one more thing. Isaiah, don't let Sharon win.
Our second book is Buzzkill Number 4, written by Donnie Cates, story by Cates and Mark Resnick, with art by Jeff Shaw and coloring by Lauren Aff. It's published by Dark Horse Comics.
This was great.
We're not even going to give a bit of a recap on what this is about. Come on.
It was so good.
I'm just going to say it's about a superhero dealing with his addiction and finding the repercussions from that.
I'm going to counter that with It's not about a superhero dealing with his addiction. It's about a man dealing with his addiction.
Come on.
Yeah, no, for real. I think that when you tell me that Francis was a superhero first, I don't know.
Okay.
I think that it's about a guy dealing with the stuff that guys, well, maybe I shouldn't say guy. It's about a person dealing with the stuff that people have to deal with when they're going through a struggle with addiction.
Yeah, but at the same time, how many people who struggle with addiction have to deal with a league of supervillains who are looking to destroy you when you're not, you know, in your drunk?
It's just context. It's just, you know, it's the way that the story is packaged. I mean, I'm just giving you shit, but I just think that one of the things that's so beautiful about this story is that it is very relatable from a, like, humanity perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
And the fact that he has superhero powers when he consumes drugs or alcohol is, you know, a nice hook, but at the core, he's dealing with a very human struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you wanted to take the metaphor further, it's what does an addict feel like when they're trying to overcome that addiction? It's sort of this monumental feat anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And addiction is more than substance abuse so often, too. It's dealing with the emotional issues that come along with why you use the drugs in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just because, you know, sure, maybe it seems like the only way you can face the world and face the troubles that, you know, confront you is to be inebriated or, you know, saturated or something like that.
Huh. Should I take this personally that you're on your second, third?
Sometimes all
drink.
You can't pick up that microphone and you can't dial Skype unless you are drunk.
Well, the rest of the world thanks you for your decision today, Aaron Myers, yeah, because it definitely is more entertaining.
Yeah, you're all enablers. This is all on you.
Yeah.
You've destroyed my family. You've destroyed my livelihood.
Really?
I don't know. Probably still getting paid.
Right. I also think I have a lot of work to do if that's my goal. Destroying your livelihood? That's like fucking epic.
Yeah, but this is how you work.
What, I'm more insidious than that?
Yes, you play the long con. Anyway, I don't want to short shrift this book because I don't like to talk poorly about other comics, but so there is part of this to me was I was hesitant when I first heard about the solicit for this book because
we were burned this year by something else.
Right, we were burned this year by something else that was also written by somebody who was a musician, celebrity, etc., and it was awful. And and I saw this and I'm like, another one of these celebrity, you know, rock star kind of books.
Right.
And this is the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
Like, this did not disappoint. This is really well done. The art was fantastic. The writing was beyond solid.
It was also subtle when it needed to be subtle. And, like, I don't even fucking care that this is turning into more of a review than an analysis. But the point that I just want to emphasize is that there's a way to do addiction in a very heavy-handed approach. And there's a way to do it where you can empathize with the character. And yet also the choice that he makes at the end, he totally lied and he totally drank and then told Nikki that he hadn't. And that's not a redeemable, like, hero kind of quality. And yet I understood exactly why he made that decision.
Wait, did he? I thought he was just smoking cigarettes.
No, dude. No, he goes to the closet and he looks and there's a rose on the top.
Now it all makes a lot more sense.
Oh my god, Aaron.
Okay,
there's a box on the top shelf.
Right. No, and the bottle. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to be honest. I was drinking when I read this book.
Oh. That's like a level beyond irony right there.
Right. So that, I'm like, what is the... like,
and yet, wait, why didn't we talk about the fact that you didn't understand it?
No, it still kind of made sense to me. I just, like, I kind of glossed over that detail, but now it's just like...
Oh, it's such an important detail.
It's like, this lightning bolt just hit me, and it's like, oh my god, this is like 100 times better than I was even thinking.
Yes. Yeah. It is so much more accurate about the recovery process in terms of
like
the length of time and the slip ups and the choices that you make and the justifications
that
you give to yourself about, like, well, this time it's going to be okay because I'm doing it for this reason, or, you know, whatever. And yet his justification was, this time it's going to be okay because I'm going to save the fucking world.
Right.
Like, you can't really argue with that. And yet, like, very, very much I empathize with the struggle that he still is in the midst of. And there's no presentation that this struggle is over. Just like in Hit, the story has concluded, but the resolution is ongoing.
Yep. No, that kind of just blew my mind a little bit.
Oh, hey, look, it was all me.
No, it's good that I feel super dumb that I missed that. And I also was not giving it at the end. I was holding back that I was like, you know, the ending was pretty good, but I don't know. I kind of was left a little lacking. Now it's like, oh man, they totally nailed it.
Well, and he says, like, sometimes the hero lies.
Yep.
And so the first time I read it, I thought, huh. And I went back and I traced the journal that he's writing in. And, like, why is that the final image that we get? And why is that reflection so important? And how does that take us back to the decision, like, that he's faced with when he's standing at the door of the closet? And I started looking for visual cues. And yeah, like, there's a box on the top shelf of that closet that then we see again and we see it again. And at the end, the bottle is open. And the fact that he lies to her about it is, like, that's a really powerful moment.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's huge. And maybe I have a problem.
I don't know. Maybe you should drink when we talk about comics, but not when you read them.
Maybe. I need to separate. I need to separate my drinking times.
You want to talk about the last one? It's going to be rough.
I need to drink more for this one.
Yeah, I think I do too.
Hi, Comics Therapy crew. As promised, this is a very drunk Allison, the gentle nerd, on Twitter. I've been drinking since noon because of my office Christmas party, but I have lots of feelings about series endings. I think the best one that I've read recently for a series was the end of Kieran Gillen's run on Journey into Mystery from Marvel. Incredibly powerful, lots of crying, a lot of Loki feels. The ending of Preacher is pretty fantastic because you can't really go wrong with a story where the bad guy is God, and how do you end that story? And I think the best ending of any series, any medium at all ever made, series finale of Star Trek The Next Generation. If you don't get a warm, fuzzy feeling when you watch that, I feel like there's something missing from you. Also, thank you, Comics Therapy, and to your whole network for coming to my rescue and my husband's rescue with the ornament drive. You guys are all wonderful. Everyone who has sent ornaments is wonderful. I love you all. Merry Christmas.
Our final book is Lock and Key Alpha Number 2, published by IDW. Lock and Key is written by Joe Hill, with art by Gabriel Rodriguez, coloring by Jay Photos, and lettering by Robbie Robbins.
And again, if you haven't read any Lock and Key, then seriously, I implore you, please don't spoil it for yourself. Skip ahead to the interview with Simon Oliver, and when you're done with that, go and read Lock and Key immediately. Just don't listen to the next segment until you do. It is that good.
Yep. This is honestly a top 10 book of all time for me.
I think it's in my top 3.
Well, that's crazy. Nobody should be able to pick their top 3. But
I'm just saying, I have read less than you have, but I think that without trying to define what the other two are, I'm having a hard time not just being so in love with this book.
Yeah, this is a masterpiece of comic books.
Yeah. Yeah, that's that. I applaud that work.
I was very nervous about this last issue, and an epilogue issue is easy to pull at the heartstrings, but it's hard to make you feel both distraught that it's over with and feel still that you completed the story.
Mm-hmm.
and this hit on, you know, on all of that?
I own all of the hardcovers, and I own it in digital, in the digital volumes. And when the last volume comes out, I'll buy it in hardcover. And when the last volume comes out together in, digitally, I'll buy that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we review a little bit? Because I just want to talk about art.
Yeah. For this one, yeah. Yeah, we can.
I mean, it's not even that much of a review, but Gabriel Rodriguez, like, made this book so real and impactful for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's... art matters so much, but, you know, especially one person doing a book through,
right,
in this case, was so important too.
Right.
Like, it built the world.
Yeah. Well, and
somebody so talented, you know, it's like you never felt the art was lacking, and you never felt that it wasn't everything it was supposed to be.
Well, like, specifically, he's such a master of, he's a master draftsman, and his sense of place is very grounded, like architecturally with the house and with the layout of the house. But yet he has a kind of brilliant attention to detail in his cartooning, but that it never goes to the point of being so realistic that it's off-putting. Like, it's not photorealistic ever. It's just so
right. And even the gory precise parts are not, they're not done to the point where it's like torture porn or something.
Yeah. It's a really unique style. It really is. I just don't think that there are not a lot of other artists that I can think of, even artists that I love, who could have rendered this story even close to as successfully, because I think there's a lot of emotion, especially in the faces that he's able to capture. And that, because of some of the horrors and like the trauma that the Locke kids go through, that the facial expression was so important. And
that starts from issue one. That first issue is like, I remember reading that and being like, oh, I don't know if I want to go on with this, but something still compelled me.
Right. And I don't know if you remember, because I think I started reading this last spring.
Okay.
But this is another one that, like, you recommended, and it was non-negotiable.
Yeah, this is another one of those, like, five series that brought me back to comics.
Right. So you're like, wait, you're not reading this? You need to. And like, we cannot be friends unless you do this immediately.
Yeah.
And it's also another one that I remember, like, texting you at mid read. I don't know if I can do this, Aaron. This is crazy. This is scary. Blah, blah, blah. Like my normal MO.
Yeah.
And yet there was never a point that I thought I could stop. And I think it was probably the third volume that was, I mean, speaking of like addiction, it was one of those, like, I can't, like, everything else around me stopped. I just burned through the third one. And then I picked up the fourth one, and it is such an overwhelming masterpiece of storytelling, like full package.
Well, I can only relate it to people this way too. Like, my wife Chrissy just finished it, and just really just started reading it last month. I think I finally, like, I put it on her tablet and I said, you have to read this. And I neglect the kids. She doesn't have the same luxury. But, you know, like, she had to read it. You know, she was waking up early with Logan and letting him cry on the floor in a pile of his own filth because she had to read it.
Right. Awesome.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding about that part. But, you know, it was the kind of thing the 6-month-old would wake her up at 4:30, time to read Lock and Key.
Right.
You know, so she just finished it too. And that's, it's that good that you have to read it. You just have to.
So here's how I feel about it ending. And I agree with you that there have been some other kind of epic series that when you know that they're coming to their conclusion, like, it could be a little dodgy. Like, not everybody knows how to handle an epilogue. This was brilliant. I don't feel like the conclusion of this could be anything other than what happened. I am completely fulfilled. I am overjoyed with the good guys winning in that regard. And I'm...
the good guys winning. It's a fine line of, yes, the good guys won, not without loss, not without great loss, but absolutely, we still have enough of a cathartic release of good things that happen.
Right.
You know, it's not the bummer ending, and it's not the overly happy ending. A great ending both leaves you feeling sad, happy, relieved, and miserable at the same time.
Right. And I know that this is a bit of a stretch in a lot of ways, and I'm not trying to make a comparison in terms of content, but I feel that the ending of Lock and Key and the ending of, like, the Harry Potter series were both successful in that balance of loss and, you know, good overcoming evil. So that at the end of the day, you have this contained story and ups and downs and all kinds of struggle within that story. But the conclusion, the ending, like that final moment, you're like, yes, everything is fine. And that was a good use of my time to absorb that story into my brain.
Yep. Yeah, no, I have nothing else to say or or disagree with or put in. It's great.
I'm going to miss it, but I also will really enjoy rereading it.
Yeah, and it didn't go past its prime, which is important too.
Knowing how it ends, going back and looking for clues along the way, I'll really enjoy that process also.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk to somebody who is still around and still doing things? I don't have a good transition.
You don't.
And I'm not going to
Maybe
even try.
Maybe I should write those for you.
No, sometimes they're good.
Not today.
Well, I have an excuse.
Greetings, Aaron and Andrea. This is Roderick Ruth here at Roderick Ruth on Twitter. And my nerd confession for best character death / best ending goes to Walking Dead issue number 100. Just remembering how brutal and sad it was that I think I was on the brink of tears. In case you're still grief counseling, Andrea, I won't spoil it for you entirely. The best ending in general for me goes to Why the Last Man. I think Brian K. Vaughan gave such an honest and true ending and handles it in such a deep way that it tugs on my heartstrings thinking about it. I think I have some water leaking from my eyes now. Thanks, guys.
This week on the couch, we welcome Simon Oliver. Simon is currently writing Vertigo's ongoing FBP, Federal Bureau of Physics, with artist Robbie Rodriguez. He is writer of The Exterminators, also published by Vertigo from 2006 to 2008. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
Hi, how's it going?
Going fantastic.
So, Simon, besides FBP, do you have any other comics projects that you're working on that you want to just let us know about, like, right off the bat?
I have a bunch of things that I can't really talk about, unfortunately. I'm sworn to secrecy. If I told you, I'd have to hunt you all down and kill you. So,
please don't do that.
Yeah, you know, I've got a bunch of stuff. There's a couple of comic things that might come through, but then the game may completely explode into the ether and nothing may ever happen. I've got a couple of movie projects, the same thing, that may just explode and be nothing. So yeah, it's a lot of stuff. I'm always busy, but as to whether any of these things will ever be talked about in public, we never know.
sure, we get that. How about FBP specifically? What's the long-term plan for that story? Do you guys have it kind of all mapped out?
I have some kind of waypoints mapped out that I'm working towards now. We got renewed, or my contract got renewed for another 12. So I've just finished writing number 12. And so I've got, my contract takes me up to 24.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, which is great. It means there's another year and a half of issues at least to come out. And what I'm planning to do is to, you know, take us up to a certain point, answer a lot of the questions that are kind of being posed and raised now, and kind of not hit reset as such, but kind of move the goalpost dramatically a little bit after the first 24 issues, if we go longer than that, which hopefully we will.
Yeah, but that's great. That's exciting that there's a least another, you know, for readers, 18 months worth of issues, you know, to expect.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, of course, they could, you know, they could pull the plug at any moment. I mean, my final contract for the Exterminators was longer, and I had to wrap it up in a couple of issues. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. So far, things seem to be going quite well sales-wise, and the response seems to be good, and I think the book... You know, I've just, like I said, I'm just finished number 12, so I'm kind of 6 issues ahead, and I'm super excited about the next arc. You know, I think the book's really firing on all cylinders, and, you know, I'd like to see it continue to do so as long as it does, and when it doesn't, we'll stop doing it.
Right. Well, that kind of makes, that leads me to my next question about what's a typical writing day for you consist of? Like, what's, you know, what's a work day look like?
With the doing the comics and with the doing the issues, it takes me about a week. I've just finished doing, I think, 3 or 4 kind of back to back, and I've got a couple more to do before I can move on to anything else. Mm-hmm. I tend to spend the first 3 days staring into space and bouncing ideas around and kind of playing with things and having fun with, like, okay, what do I need to do this issue? So, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, those 3 days used to be like panic of, like, I'm never going to do this. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm faced with a blank page, and I'd get stressed out. And now it's like, okay, that's part of the process. I could easily spend 3-4 days staring into space and then actually physically writing it 2 days.
Okay.
Something like that. It's not always set in stone. It kind of depends on you know, give or take. But what has happened during the process of doing FBP with Robbie is, at the beginning of the book, I was doing scripts kind of how I always have, which is, you know, they're very tight, very long, very detailed scripts with everything. The wide, go to a 2-shot, you know, blah, 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 and it'd be very long and involve scripts. And that's how I'd always done it. And then from there on, my involvement would be kind of less. And what's happened, grabbing each of the panels, I'm like, look, these are the beats that I want to hit for this action sequence. Go ahead, take the lead. It's your thing. So the scripts are kind of getting looser, and it's more of an involved backwards and forwards process now. Like, when the pencils come in, I'll take a look, and, you know, and I'll rejigger the script a little bit as we go along. So it's kind of more of a involved process now, which I think is ultimately to the benefit of the book. It's kind of a good working pattern to get into, I think, kind of, you know, tweaking and working to the art in some places, and you know.
Was that a process for you to kind of give up some of that control?
It was kind of a relief, particularly for this book, because there's a lot of things which are hard to visualize. I'm a fairly visual person in terms of how I work. It's like I have to be able to visualize a scene to make it work. And in some places with FBP, it was hard because you're asking for, like, okay, so, you know, we've got this other dimension. Like, what does this other dimension look like? What does the effect look like? And in a way, it's kind of a relief for me to not have to visualize it so much. And I'm like, hey, Robbie, like, what do you think this should look like? Uh-huh. And take it from there. So it's actually kind of freed up my process a little bit in terms of the writing process on it.
What kind of research have you had to do for this book specifically? We talked about it back in episode 12, and we talked about the fact that the science feels very real, as opposed to a lot of the typical comic book science that, like, we accept it when we read it, but it doesn't usually come across as rooted in reality. And I've noticed that with the Exterminators also, that, like, the science part, although we're talking fantastical, it seems very rooted in the actual kind of accepted laws of our universe and science as an academic field.
Yeah, I did kind of the same with both of those books, especially because they were ongoing and you kind of got to build a foundation of something to talk about in the books. And I read a fair amount and watch a fair amount of documentaries, particularly when I'm going into a story arc, like the one I just did was kind of based on this idea of reality. And so I'll just kind of immerse myself for a couple of weeks into reading about it and see a couple of, you know, and it could be as simple as a couple of sentences here and there, which will kind of make sense to me and something that I can at least spin off. So I really, it was one of the things when I started the book was to try and at least ground it in science, and then from there I've taken some liberties obviously to get the, you know, to bring the stories alive. And you know, you take a hypothesis that someone has like thought up and you try and visualize it and try and make it real, but I do try and make it, you know, at least try and have that feeling that it's grounded in some kind of reality, that there is some kind of scientific theory behind it. And that was important from the beginning of the book, because there's a lot of, especially now, you know, every single Marvel movie seems to involve a portal to another world.
Right.
Doesn't it? I mean, the last Thor movie, I went to go see it with my kids, and I'm like, didn't we do this? Wasn't there something else? Like, the Earth was in danger. Isn't this the Avengers?
Well, you know, when in doubt, just write some time travel or a wormhole.
yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff, which is, you know, I went to go see Thor 2, I can't remember what it was called, Electric Boogaloo, who knows what it was called.
Breaking.
And yeah, it was, and it was, there was a lot of things, the kind of things that I'd have used in FBP in some ways, but hopefully, you know, in the books, I can take it like one level more to make it feel a little more grounded and not like a story device, as it kind of seemed in that movie, which was fine for what it is. But
well, in the comics too, like just like a book, you have a little more liberty to expand on theories and get into like the meat of these kind of things. Probably in a movie, you're not going to sit around talking about, you know, because people will just lose it.
No, that would be the Christopher Nolan in what was that? Inception, where you got what's her name walking around the whole time, Miss Exposition.
Yeah.
With somebody explaining it the whole time. Mm-hmm. Oh, so who watched Love Actually? Did you watch, Andrew? Did you watch Love Actually last night?
I did. Do you want to talk about
it's
it now?
It's so bizarre. Yeah, not it's a weird non sequitur. I know for anyone not you know up on the Love Actually thing, but.
No, I mean really, Simon. Like, why do you hate Christmas or joy or love?
Is that what it is, or is it love? Yeah, I was thinking about it this morning, and it's so bewildering. Like, there's a lot of movies I don't particularly like, but you kind of forget about because they're so incredibly generic. At least with Love Actually, they kind of go for it big time.
They do, actually. They really commit to like the symbolism, and I guess it's 10 years old now, so presumably a lot of the tropes that were kind of laughing about were relatively new or newer. I'm not super up on my rom-coms, but
right.
I didn't hate it, but it's
bewildering though. There are so many bits in it where I'm like Hugh Grant being the prime minister. I'm like, what is that? I mean, just, it took me half an hour to get my head around that. Like every time you come on, but what is that?
I agree.
I think, Americans might not see it the same way where we're just like, yeah, okay, whatever.
No, Aaron, totally not. Hugh Grant is absolutely not prime minister material.
Right, however, he's supposed to be right. Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton wandering perfect. In and kissing. I was like, what was that?
No, that was perfect. He was so smarmy. He was so like stereotypical American politician. It was sort of beautiful.
Yeah, and then Hugh Grant gives that speech about the U.S.-American relations, but right. Talking, it's like, oh my god, but everything said, and how like the Martin Freeman thing with he was the stand-in and they were naked pretending that, like, that's just bewildering. That was just like completely bewildering.
I had a really interesting conversation with a friend last night about all of the religious symbolism in the movie and how Rowan Atkinson's character has this kind of angelic role where he swoops in to try to convince Alan Rickman to not do the wrong thing, and then he deus ex machina is the ending, allowing Sam, the little boy, to get to his friend.
Oh god, yeah, the little boy, I was kind of hoping he'd get shot in the back when he ran through when he ran through like security, I'm like, somebody take him down. Somebody take him down.
Well, it's so fascinating because they acknowledge that the movie takes place. I mean, it's set in 2003, and they actually refer to the events of September 11th, and yet we still have this little boy running rampant. This
boy running through. I'm like, he's got a bomb. Somebody take him out.
Yeah. I don't know. If I was younger and less cynical and maybe like more primed for love, happy endings, maybe I would have been more into it. I thought a lot of it was amusing, but you know, maybe not.
I also I also cannot believe it's 10 years old as well. Yeah. Which is, I thought it was a couple of years old.
It's 10 years old.
Really? 10 years?
They look like the entire cast looks 12 years old. It's sort of astounding how.
Yes, I'm trying to think who else was in it. There was
Emma
various
Thompson
people.
And Liam Neeson.
Right. Alan Rickman. You know who else is in it is what's her name from Mad Men? January Jones is in it. Did you notice her?
No.
January Jones was one of the.
Oh yes, she's one of the young women in Minnesota.
Right, exactly. Yes. And that also, like, what was that? Like, he turns up and like, I'm like, is this a dream sequence?
I did the same thing.
Kind of throwing themselves at this kind of gawky English guy, and also being English and being married to an American wife, I'm like, she's like, oh yeah, you know, and I'm like, is it that easy? I didn't realize.
I was pretty sure that the reason why you hated this movie is because you're English. So thanks for clarifying.
Maybe that's what it is. But yeah, it's kind of. Yeah, I mean, but it's all like that Notting Hill movie with Hugh Grant opens the door and falls in love with Julia Roberts or whatever. They're all this kind of like strange, like alter world England that doesn't really exist in any way, shape or form, or at least not my version. My version of England is more kind of, you know, fights at 11:30 when the pubs turn out and, you know. England smells of urine to me. It doesn't look like any of those things.
Do you have any holiday movies that you actually like?
No, I'm not a very festive person. Does Die Hard count?
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Die Hard is one of the best Christmas movies.
Yeah, there's Die Hard. What else is set at Christmas?
Gremlins.
It is? Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I tried to watch my kids and they got scared. I think it creeped them out.
Oh, yeah. Gremlins is pretty terrifying. Like, I almost thought, I have a 3-year-old and I'm like, oh, we should watch Gremlins. And I was thinking, I'm like, no, Gremlins is really dark.
Yeah.
But a lot of those are really dark. Like even Ghostbusters is, you know, like they a lot of films like the PG-13, like the first Indiana Jones movie with the Nazis' faces melting. Right. There's no way to do that now.
Oh, terrifying. You know, even E.T. was like terrifying for me at 4 years. I was 4 years old when it came out in the theaters. And it's like there's some really pretty intense and scary parts in that.
They had trouble. My kids are now 11 and 7, and we watched that a year or two ago, and they had trouble making it. We watched it in two pieces. We watched it. They were really scared for the first act up until E.T. was found.
Mm-hmm.
It really freaked them out, and then we had to watch the rest of it the next night, and they loved it.
Hmm.
What else? I watched Stand By Me with them, which was pretty funny, because there's all those little kids smoking and swearing.
Yeah, but that's a pretty intense movie, too.
Yeah. But they loved it, but it's definitely like, you know, you're pushing the envelope.
Yeah, I could see like Stand By Me being like a 13-year-old, like the perfect at 13. You know, because it's that coming of age, that transition between childhood and teenage, you know, it's that in-between time, and that's something they would identify with more.
Yeah, but they did. They enjoyed, particularly my 11-year-old kind of really grasps onto those kind of stories at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else is a good Christmas movie, but
there's a lot of shitty Christmas movies out there.
Yeah, we've been like watching like we watched the Santa Claus, which is actually not too bad.
The one with Tim Allen,
yeah.
Tim Allen, right.
It's very dated now.
The reformed jailed cokehead.
Yeah, well, yeah. They don't touch on that so much in the movie.
They don't. They tend not to with him.
It's when he's a doing subtext.
Disney movies, right. They tend not to do that. Yeah, it's in there.
You have to look for it. It's the fine print.
Yeah, it's all to do with the snow and stuff.
Right.
It's there.
It's like Kubrick-esque, you know, symbolism in the Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Who knew it was so deep? Well, we could talk about comics again. I mean,
Yeah, let's go back to comics. We can talk about Christmas, but no, not particularly. No, Die Hard, I think, would be the only even movie that touches on some kind of Christmas thing. It's been a long time. I've been waiting to see that again. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah, me too. And I wonder if it holds up. I mean, I know people watch it nostalgically, but I don't know if it, you know, I wonder if it seems cheesy now or if it still will, like somebody who was watching it with fresh eyes would like it as an action movie.
I don't know. I think it's worth a watch. Anyway, yes, comics.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I mean, do you want a serious comics question or do you want a lighthearted, fun childhood comics question?
Whatever. You pick.
Aaron, why don't you go?
Okay. I'm Mr. Lighthearted. Andrea is okay. Mrs. Serious. So can we talk about your childhood for a second?
Oh, God. Oh, right, because this is, yes, I'm on the couch, aren't I? Yeah. Yes, my childhood.
So,
I lived in a cardboard box at the bottom of a lake.
Oh, okay.
That's no, I'm joking.
So, childhood comics memories. You know, you grew up in Europe, which is a much different comics environment than the United States. So, what were your first kind of comics influences, and what was most important to you kind of growing up?
You know, I really enjoyed, and I used to read all the time with the Asterix books and the Tintin books.
Yeah, that seems like...
Not so superheroes. I mean, we didn't really, I don't know, it just wasn't really a part of growing up for me. I don't remember them particularly being around. I remember kind of when 2000 AD started, I remember reading some of those. But really, it came back. It was always Asterix and Tintin for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a lot of like Europeans, Australians, people in India, it seems like that's a very common thing. Like that was the books they were exposed to. And that kind of shapes a lot of, it seems to shape a lot of like the literary sense too. Because just the art style is so different than what was coming out.
You know? Yes. 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 Which, I mean, I've reread some of them recently. My kids are more into Tintin than Asterix. Uh-huh. But, they make for kind of interesting reading 40 years later.
Right. How did that kind of, those European comics, did they have any kind of influence on your current style writing, or did you have to adjust?
I don't think so. I don't know, because I never really got into, I mean, this is a horrible confession, but I've never really read superhero books, for example.
Sure.
And I still don't read them particularly. And at the moment, I don't really read any comics per se because, I don't know, I kind of like working and writing in a vacuum. I don't know if it makes me a better writer or a worse writer. I think part of me is maybe afraid you read them and like, God, these are really good. I'll never, you know, and you suddenly like start to freak out that your books aren't that good or I don't know. I kind of like working in a vacuum. I read a lot of books, whether they're, you know, fiction or nonfiction. I watch a lot of movies. I watch a reasonable amount of TV. And that's kind of where I'm probably coming more from that direction. So I don't know what particularly influences me. Like with FBP, I'm not sure what I would say. Like, oh, I, you know, because sometimes you go into a project, it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I did a version of that with this? You know, you have kind of a starting off point. And there really wasn't one so much with FBP. There was one funny thing though, when we were playing around at the beginning with the overall concept and the tone of the book after, you know, I'd come up with the idea of physics being broken and stuff. And I'd come up with this idea that I'd sent to Mark Doyle, my editor at Vertigo. And it was more like these quantum tornadoes ripping across the Midwest and creatures from other dimensions coming through. And then these guys had to battle them. Uh-huh. And it was basically, which I didn't realize at the time, because we did this a while ago now. I've been working on the book for, I don't know, a couple of years at this point. Mm-hmm. There was a delay. They wanted to publish it later and blah, blah, blah. It was not a very interesting story. But it was basically Pacific Rim.
Right. Except you do it in the Midwest.
But without, yeah, and said I was doing it in the Midwest, and Mark was like, I think we should go for something a little less. And I was even like, you know, these guys who battle these creatures that come through, they're like heroes, they have trading cards, and it was basically everything that was in Pacific Rim, which was super funny, and I'm glad we didn't go in that direction, because of the timing, it would have looked like, you know, for the, you know, people just picking up the book, they're like, this is Pacific Rim, only set in the Midwest.
It would be like they, like, you know, when they, whenever there's a big blockbuster movie, there's always these knockoff movies that come out right at the same time on DVD.
Exactly. Which I think there was for Pacific Rim as well. There usually is.
Yeah, there was the one I saw that was the knockoff for Pacific Rim. There was, it's called Atlantic Rim.
Oh, okay, yes. And I think I saw there was an article or something. I think I read about that. I used to work. I as you guys know, or maybe other people know, I live in Los Angeles and have worked in the film business prior to doing comics. I used to be a camera assistant, and I used to work when I first started. I used to work on a lot of like low budget B movies like that. Which were just hysterical. I'd just be in tears laughing. I mean, just ridiculous, terrible, terrible movies. And then they'd get a big star. Like, all the budget would go on bringing, like, Dennis Hopper in. Literally, who has no interest in being there. He knows it's a piece of shit. And what these companies would do was they'd buy stock footage from much more successful movies. You know, like Hunt for Red October, they bought all this footage, and so they used the footage to then make three submarine movies.
Right.
They shot all on the same stage, and you go, like, one week it would be a space movie, and then they'd paint all the sets white or whatever, and then the next week it'd be a submarine movie, and they'd paint them a different color, and then move the stuff around. But it was just hysterical. I used to love working on those things, because they were so bad.
It seems like that would be a lot of fun, because it's sort of a lower pressure to succeed.
Yeah, and they were just, I mean, everyone kind of knew that they were terrible. You kind of had to, I mean, across the board. And, you know, there are certain directors, and that was their bread and butter. They don't make them so much anymore, and I definitely don't make them in Los Angeles anymore. But it was doing, like, low-budget B-movies. It was like the Roger Corman kind of end of the business, but it was different companies from him, like spin-offs from Corman. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people have done it in Los Angeles, done those things, and it was great fun working on them, and I'm sure they're very similar to those kind of things.
Yeah, well, you see them come out all the time on the Sci-Fi Channel now.
Right. Yeah, I wonder sometimes, like, I keep waiting to stumble across a couple that you know, that I worked on, and I know they, you know, what some would be, I did a bunch with Michael Dudikoff. Do you even know my Michael Dudikoff?
No.
He was in, like, American Ninja.
Okay.
He was the American Ninja, and he was just this incredibly unpleasant man. But they used to pay him a fortune because he was really big in the Middle East. And so they'd make these terrible movies, and then, you know, it would get a theatrical release in, like, you know, Jordan or the Yemen or somewhere. Uh-huh. And he was a big star there. Apparently they'd named a mountain after him somewhere.
That's amazing. Yeah, you don't think of the, you know, being so kind of so blinded by the, or blinded to the rest of the world. You don't think of these kind of outside sources for these where entertainment can go, where it would have a totally different life than it would here, you know, in the United States.
I've heard that David Hasselhoff is huge in Germany.
Exactly. So it was kind of like, what is that?
Yeah. Maybe we're missing out on something. We're missing out
on
something.
Well, there are some things that have been really big in England. Like, The Shawshank Redemption is like the number one voted movie of all time in England.
Well, that's fine, here, that's an amazing movie. Like, I support that.
It's a good movie. It's a good movie, but is it, you know, is it better than The Godfather or Apocalypse Now?
Right.
You know... and then there are things that are big there are English things that are big in the States that were never that big in England.
Yeah.
Like Hugh Grant.
No, he's pretty big. I think he's pretty big in both places, unfortunately.
He's beloved by all.
Yes.
Well, I got another comics question for you because, okay, you know, ostensibly that's what we're talking to you about, right?
Okay. It's comics, yeah.
In both Exterminators and FBP, you seem to be pretty committed to populating your worlds with a pretty diverse cast of non-white characters from across socioeconomic spectrums, but without exploiting them or, like, mining them for cheap laughs. Can you talk a little bit about that decision and why it seems to be important to you? Because it's one of those things that I notice, and I'm going to keep pointing it out until we don't have to keep doing that.
Right. It's funny, with Exterminators, it was a definite... Exterminators was based in Los Angeles, and it was based very much kind of on the eastern side of Los Angeles where I live.
Uh-huh.
So it was always going to have non-white characters in it. ethnicities, but you know, like I had the Cambodian in there, and you know, I tried to take a lot of people from kind of who came from kind of darker places and moved to the States, you know, even if it's the girl coming from Guatemala or, you know, the guy coming from Cambodia with the mysterious past. And it was a definite decision. It was funny with FBP, or formerly known as Collider.
Right.
I'm still stumbling. I'm still like getting my head around that. But it wasn't so much of a conscious decision. And what happened when Robbie got involved and started doing the character sketches, he was like, you know, I want this guy to be Middle Eastern and put him in a turban. And I'm like, fine, go with it. That's fine. And that's kind of been kind of Robbie almost kind of picked up that ball and ran with it. And I'm like, I'm just going to write these people as they are in my mind. And he can draw them whichever ethnicity he wants them to be. And cool. That's kind of how it's worked out, which I think kind of works.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's not heavy-handed ever, but it's a, you know, a kind of visual variety that gives the book a lot of, I don't know, it just, it feels more realistic to my world, and therefore is more approachable and more enjoyable. But that's just, that's a completely non-objective point of view as a reader.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it works. I mean, also, I started the book without a female character in it. And as of the last issue, actually number 5, she comes in right at the end.
Yes.
And then she has a 6 and 7, this Rosa character who's coming in to be the new agent in the team. I didn't start the book with a female character, but I always knew that I wanted to bring one in. And this is something my wife pointed out with Exterminators, was like, you know, your book's borderline misogynist. Like, all the women in it are awful. And it was kind of like, oh, I guess you're right. And I wanted to do something slightly different, but at the same time, like you're saying, you don't want to be super heavy-handed with, you know, you don't want it to be what's the word for it? You just don't want it to be heavy-handed with, like, okay, here's the woman, and then, you know, you can go one of 3 or 4 ways with her, probably not even that many. You can do the comic thing of, like, you know, let's give her big tits, and, you know, the guy's image of a powerful woman ends up being Laura Croft or something, where they have to be, like, this kick-ass, like, whatever sex thing. But, oh, yeah, we've made a strong female character. It's like, well, you have, but at the same time, you haven't really. You've made some kind of fantasy thing. So I bought in this new character and trying to be aware of the fact that she's a female, but at the same time, you don't want to go stereotype and go the familiar tropes with her. And it's something I've been tackling with in the last arc, is like, it's ridiculous to have these two people in the book and not have their, not have some kind of sexual spark between them. To ignore that would be ridiculous, but at the same time, you don't want her to fall in love with him or
have him constantly saving her.
Exactly. You don't want her to be the damsel in distress all the time. You want to flip it around sometimes and play with that. And I think what I'm doing now, this might even reference back to kind of starting points with their relationship, was, you know, why don't we kind of go in X-Files style Mulder and Scully type will they won't they thing. You know, there's that sexual tension between them, but you never felt like the female character gave anything up in that for that relationship, or, you know, she didn't become any less female. It was kind of a realistic way of handling it. Like, she didn't suddenly become the damsel in distress, or she didn't all of a sudden become starry-eyed or something. So it's an interesting thing to play around with, you know. I mean, ultimately, at the book, you hope at the core of it, you have the characters and their relationships.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting to hear you acknowledge the book started. I mean, that was one of the very few, I'm not even going to call it a criticism. It was just something I noticed at the very beginning about the lack of female characters that played a substantial role. So that's shifted very dramatically, very quickly with issue 5 and 6 with the addition of Rosa. And I'm completely fine with that. I mean, it's building the character relationships, and that's what we all get off on. We want to see them interact in this environment, in this world that you've created.
Right.
and the fact that Rosa is not predictably Lara Croft type is refreshing and makes her addition to the team and as a partner much more compelling as a journey to kind of watch unfold.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, I hit the action pretty hard and fast in that first arc, and I wanted to get it started. I didn't want there to be too much build up, and I wanted to throw them in, and I wanted to kind of develop the characters as we went. And I know there was some criticism from some critics. It's like, we don't know, we don't care about these characters, and it's moving too fast, and there's too much stuff. And which I was kind of aware of, and I kind of agreed with them in some points and didn't agree with them on others. I mean, that's some of the problems with reading, you know.
Yeah, you don't read the comments.
Criticism or reviews. Yeah, you can go freaking nuts because someone will say something and then somebody else will completely contradict them. And, you know, it's like, whatever. And now I try and avoid. I did for the beginning. I read, you know, you can't help yourself, read some reviews for the first few issues. Some people loved it. Some people absolutely hated it, like I had done some kind of... It always blows me away with, like, wow, I must have really pissed you off in another life or something.
I wouldn't take it that seriously. Outrage is really inexpensive to buy on the internet. And so people spend it very freely.
Yes, it's a two-for-one deal at the moment. Right. They've supersized it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I kind of, you know, and as for me as a writer, when you're working on something, like particularly with this last arc, when the characters are really starting to come in on their own and you can really feel things clicking, and you kind of know if stuff's working for you and when it isn't, you know, if you can put the script down for a week and then come back to do a rewrite on it and be like pleasantly surprised by what you've done, you kind of know as a writer whether you really think it's kind of everything's kind of gelling together or something's not quite working for you and stuff. So you kind of have to go with that at the end of the day. You got to please yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, speaking of pleasing yourself, what kind of things do you enjoy when you're not working or writing? You know, we always talk about the work-life balance, and we find it interesting to hear what creators say about how they separate that.
Yeah, because most of you don't. Most of you don't separate work and life. Most of you have terrible work-life balance.
Yeah, I don't. I have two boys. I have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. My wife works full-time, and I work out of the house and write, and I have, and I think that kind of saves me in some ways because I have a schedule. You know what I mean? I'm not somebody like when it gets dark, I don't write. I don't put, you know, I don't put them to bed and start writing or in the middle of the night or something. I very much have kind of my schedule. Like I take them to school, I go for a run or I go to the gym and then I start work. You know, I get phone calls and stuff out the way and then I write and I probably do 4 or 5 hours a day when I'm working on a script. You know, depending on what stage, I have kind of set down kind of milestones that I try and reach during the day. And, you know, when I pick them up from school or the babysitter brings them back on those days, that's it. I'm done. I'm done for the day, usually around 4-ish or something. And not to say I'm not thinking about it all the time.
Right, but you're not actively running back to the computer.
Yeah, that's kind of my schedule. And I really try not to beat myself up. You know, and I think everyone goes through that period of their writing career where they, you know, spend a couple of years beating themselves up because they're not doing enough or, you know, it's not coming fast enough. And then you get to a certain point where you're like, you know what, it will work out.
I would say that is the healthiest response we've gotten so far.
Well, also, I think it's worth pointing out that I think that Simon is one of the few people we've spoken to who has young kids, and most of the people that we've talked to, their kids are older or they don't have them. So I think that that's I think you're right. It probably helps keep that balance by necessity.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, that part's pretty much separate. I mean, you know, that's kind of how it is. And you just, you know, I mean, I spent a couple, I think everyone has like beaten themselves up. And I did for a while. I spent a couple of years writing a spec movie script that took way too long, and in the end, it wasn't really that good. And then about a year ago, I was like, okay, I'm going to write another script. And I'm going to write it in 6 weeks, start to finish. And that's what I did. And I just started like, okay, I have to write a first draft in 6 weeks. Not, you know, you fix it in the rewrite. Doesn't matter if this scene doesn't work. You get to the end of it. And that's really liberating. It's just like, it doesn't matter if it's shit. You do 8 pages a day, 9 pages a day. You might end up throwing it all away when you do the rewrite. You might keep some of it. But the thing is just to keep that schedule and to keep doing it.
Yeah, and I assume that, I mean, Aaron and I both have kids. My son is 8. So I think that we can relate to the need for the structure, like in your own scheduled day, to correspond with or like work around your kids' schedules. And it, like, everybody's happier in that world where everybody knows what they're doing and they know what the goals are. And it makes a lot of sense that would be like a strategy for you being more productive. You're right. You get a gold star. Definitely the healthiest answer that we've heard.
I mean, you know, a year, 2 years ago, it might not have been quite like that, but, you know, I just try not to beat myself up.
Good job.
I think that's probably the key thing I learned to realize. It's just like, yeah, don't beat yourself up. It'll be fine.
So we usually ask creators about the comics that they're currently reading, but you kind of mentioned before you're not really reading so many comics these days.
Right.
But do you wanna? Are there any must reads, novel wise, or year end bests that people should check out?
Oh, I'm trying to think what I've read this year that's really blown me away. Not so much with the. I've been reading a lot of not very good books, I have to say.
Oh, no.
I just read those Guillermo del Toro. Yeah, you know what? No, even more than that, not only do I finish them, I just read those The Strain books, the Guillermo del Toro vampire things.
Yeah.
There's a trilogy. I read all of them, and they're not very good.
Right, I gave up after the first one. It was just option for a movie, though.
Oh, TV show. No,
they're doing it.
I think that's kind of why I read it. I was kind of curious to see what anyone could bring to that genre that hadn't been already ground into the ground. They've stretched out over three, but I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it was just like, you know, would I recommend it to someone? No, not really. I've been reading a lot of stuff like that. It's kind of, you read it. I'm reading something now that somebody gave to me to take a look at, and I'm like, that got optioned as a movie, and I'm like, there's some stuff in here, but does it really like justify? I don't know.
Yeah, but really. You probably know better than most people about how Hollywood is more who you know and who you can sell it to and who you can attach, and you can take a mediocre, you know, literary property and turn it into something because there's, you know, people behind it.
Right. Yeah, but but The Godfather came from a kind of a crappy pulp.
True. Right. Yeah. So you never know. So
there's diamonds. Yeah. There's definitely, you know, things that don't jump out in one medium that may actually be better suited, or, you know, does it free you up to do something? I'm reading a book now called Cocky, which is a couple of years old, and it's about a drug. It's a biography, kind of this drug dealer from Liverpool during the 1990s, who ended up getting arrested, but he became like this huge, huge drug dealer. That's kind of interesting. Yeah. And then I'm watching, you know, movies like, I don't know, I've seen some of the Oscar-y movies. I saw American Hustle. That was good.
Mm-hmm. So you have a bunch of mediocre stuff to recommend for people.
Bunch of mediocre stuff that I'm not that keen on. I like Gravity. I saw Gravity a couple of times. I like Gravity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, usually I make a whole list of the recommendations that people mention, but I don't know. I'm not really feeling.
I don't know. It's pretty weak. No, I don't know if it was on the list that you sent me. I should have put more thought into it. I'm trying to think what's really like. Oh, you know, I can't think of anything recently that I've said to anyone. Oh, you got to go see that, or you got to read this book. No, I've read a lot of, I got to up my game on the acting front, I think.
That's fine. We'll just put, like, here's a list of things Simon talked about. Eh, check them out, I guess, if you come across them.
Right. Simon doesn't necessarily recommend these, but...
I like it. It'll be different.
This was really great, Simon. Thank you so much. Do you have anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
I've slagged off Love Actually, The Strange Books. We could recap.
That's right.
Recap through all the things that I haven't particularly enjoyed this year.
Right.
It's good. It kind of takes down the holiday, you know, excitement. It's good to get some perspective on things.
Yeah, if anyone needs anything dampened down, just drop me an email. I'll rain on their parade. Yeah, pretty much.
Perfect.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And of course, thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your comics and subscribe to them digitally so we can keep just enjoying the stories we love. Show notes and other details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We'll see you all next week. There we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Excellent. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, no worries at all. Thanks for having me.
I'm just as fucked up as they say. I can't fake the daytime. I found an entrance to escape into the dark. False lights for the sun. It's an artificial nocturne. It's an outsider's escape for a broken heart. We hide out in the back like shadows in a stranger's dream. Hiding out in the back together. In the back forever. I make all that I believe in dreams so real. Babe, I have to take the call.
My favorite comic ending. A verbal essay by Ken Godberson III. My favorite comic ending belongs to my favorite piece of sequential art storytelling, the manga known as Full Alchemist by Hiromu Arakawa. Mostly known in the West for its fantastic 2003 anime adaptation, I always felt that the manga was superior, particularly because of its ending. The basic reason for loving this conclusion so much is that it manages to pull off a happy ending that actually feels earned. The two protagonists go through hell and back side by side with their comrades, some of whom were enemies in the beginning of the series. It is a culmination of over 100 chapters worth of character work, such favorites of mine being Scar, Roy Mustang, and Greed. While the world is not all sunshines and lollipops by the end, it brings a great deal of optimism to not only the future, but in humanity's ability to overcome anything. The second reason for this ending being my favorite is how every major plot point is perfectly wrapped up. I hate it when stories leave plot threads dangling. This is a pandemic in corporate-owned superhero comics because characters never get a concise and permanent ending to their stories. Being stuck in the second act, as someone described it to me once. As much as I love superheroes among DC and Marvel, I do wish some big characters would just end already after a culmination of years of character development. But clearly, this is just wishful thinking. Full Metal Alchemist has always been a benchmark of storytelling for me, and it's always what I measure books, whether they are comics or prose, against. The beginning, the middle, and of course the end are just near perfection for me. Thank you.